Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello, this is Lana. Today we'll be speaking with Kim Faulkner. Kim is an Australian author born in Santa Cruz, California. She writes speculative fiction, including science fantasy and epic fantasy released by HarperCollins. The cool thing is that she trains in the art of the Japanese sword to choreograph her fight scenes. Kim is also a published astrologer who has studied mythology, tarot, and metaphysical philosophy. Really, she is well-versed in many subjects because she's also studied alternative health, Jungian psychology, art history, quantum physics, self-sufficiency farming, marine biology, veterinary nursing, dressage, animal husbandry, scuba diving, and nursing mothers counseling. That's not all, because she's also studied yoga and knows how to play three musical instruments. Her work is contemporary and ancient, dark and uplifting, shocking and enlightening. Welcome, Kim. How are you?
Good. Thank you. And I'm just so delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
So how did you end up in Byron Bay, Australia?
Oh, a man.
Usually that's how.
Boiled down to a man, but yes, back in California long decades ago, I met a man and we had adventure on our minds and we wanted to go somewhere we'd never been before, and we immigrated to Australia before we even set foot.
Wow.
So it was an adventure. The man's not here anymore, but I am, and I love it, and I'm very happy that, whatever it takes to get me moving, that's fine.
Do you miss living in the United States at all?
There are aspects of, I'm from Santa Cruz, California, and there are things like the mountains so close to the sea and that green color of the ocean and kelp.
Yeah.
And I miss redwoods. There are a few, some things, fog. I haven't seen fog in so long, and I didn't think I'd ever miss it. But yeah, just those home things,
mm-hmm.
even earthquakes, you know, that make you feel very much alive. I lived bang on the San Andreas fault line, so.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's just part of growing up. So yeah, there are things. Of course, my family, too. sister's California, and yeah, I miss her too.
Australia is pretty similar to the U.S., though. There's a lot of things that are, I'd say of all the countries, Australia is probably the closest to the U.S.
There are a lot of similarities, and there's a lot of cultural links. I certainly haven't felt estranged in any way. I've felt very welcomed to this country. It's also has its differences, and there's something very powerful, and there's an earth magic here that you... It's amazing. I mean, you're surrounded by all these exotic birds. It's like being inside a bird sanctuary, only mm-hmm. it's just you step outside your door and there's flocks of parrots and there's marsupials and all these very ancient mammals. It's fabulous, and it's very inspiring, extremely inspiring to be here.
I think it's amazing how many interests you've studied. So when did you first begin studying astrology and occult subject matters?
Childhood, pretty much, my teens. My father was an astrologer before me, so it was just part of the life. It was part of the language, and I was very interested. In my late teens, I started studying it formally, and it kind of gave me a road in to connect with my dad. He was a very busy man and, not always had time for me. So studying astrology, I think my initial main interest was, to get his approval and get time with him to discuss the planets and the intricacies. And then, of course, it just became language of my life and... So long, many decades of it. It's just in my blood.
I think I read somewhere, too, that you said your father used astrology to basically predict things on the market, right? Financially?
He used to find it, yes. He liked to make it very practical for financial gains and so forth. And he was very successful at it. I wish I picked his brain in that department a little bit. Because when I was younger, who cares about money, finance, security? That's just not what the interest is at all. And now I'm thinking, what did he do? Anyway, yeah,
Why do you,
I oh, go,
oh, I'm
sorry.
sorry. Why do you think there's so much fear discussing occult subject matters in the mainstream?
Oh, because it's unfamiliar. It's unfamiliar, and it's been demonized. It's just like fear of empowering women. It's like fear of anything that human the culture feels estranged from, because of oh, it's just where do we start? Patriarchy, I suppose, and of course, with a lot of more open beliefs around the time of Plato and so forth, became Christianized, and there was all this conflict. I mean, the religious aspects of being had to make sense, and the idea of astrology and the idea of choice and the ideas of fate and free will worked count it was just a big can of worms for bringing in a coherent religion to bring the people together. So a lot of things were well demonized. They were considered evil, dark, sinister, counterproductive to the healthy young mind. So yeah, it's kind of had a lot of bad press for a while.
And perhaps
But
maybe
that's
that's why we're in such a bad state as well on the planet, because we haven't
well
embraced some of these concepts.
sure you narrow once you start narrowing the mind and narrowing the playing field you're definitely the priorities change and outcomes change. So of course anything that the reverse anything that opens the mind becomes curious and looking at, okay, what is this? What does this mean? What does this say about me? How can I grow from this? That creates a very different culture than one that's saying this is good and this everything else is wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the way it's gone. But we see change, and we see. I mean, we're having this conversation right now across the planet. Look how far away we are, and here we're like practically face to face, and talking about this thing in an open worldwide forum. Things have changed. Things have changed for the better.
That's right. So, at what point did you decide to begin writing speculative fiction?
I think I was five. I
Wow.
was pretty young. I've been writing all my life, and it's only really come together in the last maybe 10 years where this a particular story and a particular storyline grabbed me so hard I couldn't let go of it. And I went through, I mean, becoming a published author is probably at least as challenging as writing the book to start with. And that's just the one book. With speculative fiction, of course, we're looking at series, we're looking at stories that have long arcs, and because readers are expecting to get into that world and be in it for a while. So yeah, it's probably in 2001 or so, I actually started with the story idea and stuck with it. And then I've got my first three-book contract in 2007. So
Congrats.
thank you. Yeah, and then it's just expanded from there. So perseverance definitely pays off in the writing world.
So
You have to.
do you do quite a bit of research before you write your books?
During.
Oh, okay.
It's finding that it's during. I mean, my whole life has been research because I'm just like, yeah, definitely the eternal student.
Yeah,
And
you do a little bit of everything. I was pretty impressed with all your diplomas.
I know. It's crazy how much stuff I've done and how diverse it is. And it's just amazing because when you go to write things, I can draw on memories, and if I don't have the memory, if I don't have it right, I know how to research it. I know where to get the information. But generally, the story wells up, and the story has to be told, and I'll be ripping along, getting the story down, and I'll come to a character or an environment or a situation that something's going to happen, and I don't really understand how that could happen. So I go into the research.
So
So
you
and then. write more, and then another thing comes up and research. So it happens in the first draft. A lot of research happens there.
Okay, and then you have two book series, right? Quantum Enchantment and Quantum Encryption?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what are some of the deeper themes that you cover in those series?
Well, they are basically, those six books are this one big giant story arc. They're based in two worlds, a futuristic Earth, which is it's a dystopia. There has been environmental collapse. There's been government collapse. There's been tectonic plate shifts. The only currency is drinking water. It's a very dark place. And technology has just crumbled. As a matter of fact, technology has turned around and absolutely bit them in the ass in ways that nobody expected. So there's this quality in that world of something being very advanced and very futuristic, but the themes of geoengineering, the themes of gender biases, and the themes of water and environment and so forth are extremely relevant to what's happening right now. So the speculative side of it gives us distance, so we can get into the story and we can go, oh, this is happening, and we're gripped by it. In ways that if we saw this on the news, it would have a completely different effect. There would be a distancing that in the story, you can fall into it. So there's the Earth, the dystopian Earth that's a near future. And then there's a parallel world, because I use a lot of quantum physics theory, including the many worlds theory. So we've got this parallel Earth called Gaela. And it's completely different. There is no technology. It's a magical hegemony. It's agrarian. Genders are equal. And there's a lot of empowerment. There's also, they have different sort of problems there. And, of course, a porthole opens between them. And there are links between them that we discover as it goes along. And it's amazing. The reason why this all burst into the books was one sentence, one idea of a writer that I just idealize, Arthur C. Clarke, and he said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
That's right.
And I always get chills when I think about that. I wanted to know how can that be true? Where is that true? And what would that look like? And so on Gaela, we have a world where the air quotes magic is basically it's basically thoughts becoming things very fast, right? Instead of taking their time, they do in this world. There is an instant, atoms rearrange in an instant, thoughts become things instantaneously, and they call it magic. Whereas, of course, on Earth, they're still struggling to patch up whatever technology they can salvage, etc. So it's a really interesting, contrasting worlds to write in and see what happens to characters when you put them in both these situations.
Definitely. So do you think in real life, do you think that we're heading somewhere spooky with all the technology and possibly even AI coming in?
Well, I think what I think is if we lack awareness, it's very easily could go the way my futuristic Earth has gone extremely easily. It could be all set up for that, but I don't believe in it. I believe in Gaela. Mm-hmm. I believe that we have it right here, right now, the ability to create whatever we want in this reality. And it's all where we want to put our focus. So I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Yeah, definitely answers it. Yeah, we have everything already within us, but we've just been so out of touch. We're not actually accessing it. Our own technology. I mean, when you think about it, the body is technology, right?
Exactly.
If we're spirits in I call it the flesh bag suit, you know?
Okay. Yes. Very, That's very literal. Beautiful. Yeah.
Do you think some of your characters or stories might come from some kind of past life memory?
I know that a lot of them come from this life memory. An author can only bring themselves to the work. You're just bringing yourself to it. You're, even when you're researching or whatever you're doing, that's what you're getting. And there, I think even fiction can be quite autobiographical, mm-hmm. which is a little embarrassing right at the moment to think about, because don't think about it that way when you read. You won't, because you'll be in the story. But it is. And there are so many things. I meditate. I've been meditating for 40 years? Yes, 41 years. Well, another gift from my dad, transcendental meditation.
Well, that's a great gift.
Yes, astrology and TM. And other things too. But through meditation, I can tell you, there is a blurring in me when I think of what I remember in this life and what I remember in whatever, I don't know how to define it, but the greater whole, the ability to connect with everything. We're all connected. We're absolutely all connected. And when you tune into that, I'm not sure how we label things, you know, a past life or a current life or to channeling someone else, or because ultimately we are, it's Brahmasmi, I am the universe. We are all one. So I'm really getting far out from the question now.
No, I love it. You can go with it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But in terms of past life, I think everything, when you're writing, when you're in the creative process, and you would know this with music and with writing too, you are opening the doors. We call it the muse, but you're opening the doors to your memories, to the collective unconscious memories, and maybe your past lives dwell in there too. You are opening the doors. So, of course, it's going to be in the books.
Yeah, that's right. How could it not be?
For the painting, yes. So, long story short, yes.
Do you think it's possible for new mythologies to be born?
We're doing it, and we have to do it. Yes, I do believe that. And this is what speculative fiction does, because it's asking what if, and we're starting to write stories that combine technology and magic and myths and memories and ideas of the law of attraction. We're combining these, and by reading these stories, it is like participating in the mythic journey. Because basically our old myths are not equipped to deal with the world that we've got right now.
That's right. They're good point.
They weren't written for me talking to you. How many are we like 10,000 miles away?
Yeah.
This is like mental telepathy, almost.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah. Because, our thoughts are just going back. I don't know. I'm looking at my computer screen, you know, and there you are. So we don't have mythologies for that, except maybe shamans who are time travelers, you know, and popping up in different times and different, because even for me to get to where you are, it would take a day. This is time travel and telepathy all in one, what we're doing, right?
Yeah.
And we need those mythologies to ground us, to give us a storyline, to know how to be. And I think writers do it, artists do it. They are the shamans that are helping us, musicians do it, helping us cope with our new world.
Yeah. And unfortunately, sometimes those fields really get hijacked. So it's like, what knowledge is really going to be preserved, you know?
Well, yes. Then we set intentions. We set strong intentions about what is preserved and what is meaningful. And paradigm shifts happen when we set strong intentions and we see it happening now. Not to worry about it not happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, you know, being open and also being focused and believing in what can be.
Well, some of your work really explores a changing paradigm. So do you think that we really are in the midst of a changing paradigm? And what do you think we're changing into?
Absolutely. I believe this is a changing paradigm. You can just feel it all around you. And it's not, I mean, reality, I'm doing air quotes again, reality out there is, in the big picture, from the big perspective, it's a projection of consciousness, right? And we've got this consensus, collective consciousness that is projecting this reality. And let's just look, let's just have a brief look at what we see out there. It's radical. And there has been no time in the history of humankind where we could see this much of the world and know what is going on in an instant. I mean, I can go on Twitter and I can find out what's happening all over the world in like really intimate details, not just, you know, who had what for breakfast, but
you know, when someone's washing the dishes.
Exactly. And who just broke up, and probably bigger things like political whatever. Yeah. But, you know, I can be intimately connected with all the whole globe and get, you know, this bird's eye view into this world of ours, this reality, and it is so diverse. It is so extremely, there is such an extreme, and I think when we see that extreme, we know that we're in for transformation.
Yeah, I feel it too. It's there.
Yeah, the metaphor is like when a cell, I should have looked up my scientific, just any scientist out there or biologist, put your hand up because, but you'll know what I mean. I'm not going to use the big words. But this, when a cell goes to divide, you can watch this on YouTube. It's amazing. But you will see the nuclei will, the DNA strands will all gather at a polarity, like they will split and they will gather at either end of the cell. And you have this absolute extreme thing happening, and then bloop, suddenly you have two cells. And I think that's what we're doing right now, metaphorically, of course. I think that light consciousness is, of course, drawn to light consciousness. And the more people that are becoming more aware, more open, are meditating, are raising the consciousness of the planet, they are doing their thing, and we are doing our thing with this. And it is what's going to lift the entire collective into a higher level of awareness. We just need 1%.
I think
1% of the population.
I think too, maybe some of that is even integrating with our higher self. If we're not all completely in our body, maybe getting in touch with the rest of us that's out there somewhere in the cosmos, and then becoming more powerful here in this realm.
Exactly. It just, you connect with source, and it changes everything. It makes you feel lighter. You worry less about anything, and there's a sense of empowerment, and there is lack of judgment. Things that before, you know, oh, that's bad and that's good, not so much anymore. It's just, okay, this is all energy. And it's amazing the level of peace and just peace that you feel when you are connected to that higher source, that's higher self, the higher, we call it higher because, you know, we're linear and we have to put it somewhere on the scale. But this aspect of ourselves that with awareness, we feel connected to, and it changes everything. Absolutely.
Well, you read about parallel universes. Do you think that we do exist in other parallel universes?
Oh God, yes. Yes, absolutely. And there's some just wonderful theories out there. And one in particular that it really interests me. And if anyone reads my series, if you get to Arrows of Time, you're going to find out how very much it interests me. But the idea that, okay, it's related to M theory, which is the like the next step up from, so we had string theory and everybody got very excited about it and thought, oh, this is going to be it. And but there were too many. We kept finding more and more and more theories. It wasn't the unifying theory that everybody was after. And now the next one in the hot seat is M theory, which is like a has been born out of the string theory idea. But and the concept around it is that yes, all these multiple universes with multiple versions of ourselves doing slightly different things. And one of the ideas that kind of links to law of attraction is that when you know how the idea of law of attraction is like attracts like, and if you don't like what you're living in, then you have to change your vibration.
Mm-hmm.
You change your thoughts about it, because if you think differently about your situation, it will have to change because you've shifted your vibe. And one of the ideas is that when you change your vibration, you're popping over to that other universe where that is your vibe. Mm-hmm. And that basically our consciousness is popping around to our through these different universes that we exist in with our different, slightly different vibrations. That's one idea. I like that a lot.
I like that too, because then it means we can overcome anything and change anything.
Oh, exactly. Exactly, because we can.
We're not,
if you can imagine it. Yeah, oh no, there's no trap. There's absolutely no trap. No trap going on. But they, I don't know who they are, but part of the theory is that when you have an experience, we've all done this and we can all think about it for a second. You have this experience where life just changed dramatically. It's like, and you almost say to yourself, what universe am I in now? You just, something happened. There's an event and your life is just different. Your outlook is different. The person that you're whatever is just different. And they say those peak points are points that you pop to your different universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's exciting to think about. And the idea is it's not important whether we grab onto that and go, I believe that or not, but just to allow for the possibility of that, that opens the mind.
We also live in such a dualistic world, you know, it's like light and dark, negative, positive. Do you think that if the world was just peace all the time and love, that we would be progressing, or is that just not part of what's going to happen on this planet, this experience?
That's such an interesting question. And it's one that I ponder, because as a storyteller, okay, as an author, when you write a story, what makes it interesting, oh, they've got this saying, take your characters, chase them up trees and throw rocks at them. Basically, you got to put, what makes a good story is this gripping conflict and contrast. It's the contrast. Here I've got these worlds, and one is, I mean, like terrible things happen in this one world. And then we pop over to this other world where we experience a completely different thing. And we are in a world of contrast, and it is the contrast that we don't like, the experiences that we go, ouch, or yuck, or ooh, that helps us understand what we do want.
Mm-hmm.
And it shapes us and changes us. And we're in this playground. We're at this point in time. And I think we're all exactly in the perfect place for us right now. And whether consciousness is going to evolve into, as you said, into this experience of just bliss, no contrast. That sounds to me like we are, okay, completely in our source energy, completely in our higher self. And probably there would be no body, because the actual physicality of the body creates contrast. It has to be fed. It has, mm-hmm. you know, there, it has to be kept fit. Otherwise, oh, there's discomfort, or, oh, I just climbed that hill. Now I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. You know, there's contrast just being in a body. And we all know.
Yeah, it's work.
Yes. creates contrast. So it's almost to me that feeling of bliss and that feeling of unity and that oneness that I get when I meditate. I'm not aware of my body. I have no body awareness at that time. And it is, it's pure consciousness. And I don't know how that would work in this reality.
Yes.
I suppose, I mean, we can speculate that because reality is it's an externalization of consciousness, as consciousness shifts, we'll start to experience out there as being quite different. But in the physicality, in the bodies, I mean, just look at nature. Everything eats everything else.
Yeah.
Everything. Everything is just this full cycle, and nature is so beautiful, and it is so full of contrast. I don't know if I can answer that question.
I think it's hard with the Earth brain, the way we're wired. It's almost like we're rigged, so we can't even answer that question.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one to think about, though, and I appreciate that you brought that up, because that makes it very interesting. I don't think I'd be selling a lot of speculative fiction in that world, but I'm doing other things, I guess. So
how do you view the current state of global unrest then?
Pardon?
How do you view the current state of just global unrest?
Well, another very interesting question. I don't focus on it. That's going to sound strange without explaining, but I put my focus on what lights me up, because Jung said this thing is so beautiful and it's just stuck with me all these years. He said, if there's something wrong with society, then there's something wrong with the individual. And if there's something wrong with the individual, I need to go look in the mirror. And I think what I really got from that is the place to work on all the unrest in the world, the only place to address that is in our own hearts, in our own beings. And when I experience stillness and peace in me, I am contributing to that, to the world. The fact that we do, you know, if I don't watch the news, but of course I hear things on Twitter and other connections, obviously, and then I go research and I go, oh my God, they're doing that. But yeah, they're doing that. So yeah, obviously when I'm exposed to these experiences of unrest and this, like I said, the huge contrast of how people live and how, in some ways, people can be incredibly generous. In other ways, it's just like, oh my God, what are they doing? I think what we are experiencing, again, is the externalization of where we are as a collective. And the unrest is not the enemy. I think ultimately the unrest or the disturbance and all that contrast is helping people understand what they really do want. And again, the more people that meditate, if we get 1% of the population meditating, we're going to shift that, and we're going to slowly ease that and shift it and move it into a obviously more loving and more beautiful experience.
Definitely. And I think there's probably a second phase to that, and that's saying no more, putting your foot down and boycotting maybe certain products that are, you know, poisoning people and whatnot.
Yes, that's part. Thank you. Yes, exactly. And I do that all the time. Mm-hmm. They're not, I think it's important to distinguish between saying no to something, choosing not to participate, and fighting against. I think when we do push against it, anything, fight against it, we're feeding it. And this is a very difficult concept, really, for us, especially as, you know, warrior evolved humans, where, you know, the conflict resolution was, you know, club them over the head. That's fine. So we coming from, you know, we coming from that, and it takes time to shift it. But the more we push against something, the more we fight it, the more we're putting our attention on it, and the more our attention is on it, the more of it we will see. So personally, for what I do is focus on what's going right. So like for me, it's very hard for me to think about chickens with just example. I don't know. I don't even want to talk about it because I don't want to think about them. But I know that there are just a lot of chickens in the world that have really horrible short lives.
Yeah.
And okay, I don't think about that. I think about, and I'm not a vegetarian, I think about free-range chickens.
Yeah, exactly.
and I only support and will only participate in free-range chickens and free-range eggs. So I don't know if that helps.
No, of course it does. It's a good example.
But if I went out there with a protest sign and marched on chicken farming, I am energetically putting my focus, and anybody who will take a snapshot of me or march with me, all that focus is going on chicken farming in the way that we don't want to chickens.
Yeah, good point.
And that's not helping. That's not helping. That's not helping. So if I want to help chickens, I support free range, and I think about every time I like see a chicken, you can think I'm nuts, but this is what works. every time I see a bird flying free, oh God, there's a lot of wildlife around here, and bush turkeys. Oh my goodness.
I remember those.
Yeah. Crazy birds, aren't they? But very primitive, not super smart. But I look at them and I just appreciate them. I appreciate their freedom and their the poor little deers when they try to fly. It's not super successful, but you know, I just love them and appreciate them. That will do more for all the birds in the world than marching against a factory farmer. And of course, it's important to educate, but you need to educate without putting the focus on what you don't want. You put your focus on what you do want, and the what you don't want diminishes.
That's right. I think that's an excellent viewpoint you have there. I know you're also skilled in the ancient art of the samurai sword. So what is the way of the peaceful warrior?
Oh, you're bringing all the contrast.
Maybe that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. It's great. And the whole samurai training, it came about in a really interesting way. I had written, this is back in, I don't know, early 2000-something, and I'd written the first I had maybe 3 or 4 chapters of the first book in the series, which is The Spell of Rosette. And I had a friend who's an author, and she is also a sensei in the Iaido, in the samurai sword. And I gave her the chapters to read. She's also Sagittarius, and so she she has no problems saying exactly what she thinks, and not many filters. So
I admire people like that.
Yeah. And I was trying to keep admiring her. But she was great. She's super helpful. She came back and she said, "Fabulous story, Kim. You don't know squat about sword." And she said, "That's, you know," and she just X'd almost every paragraph that had any kind of sword, anything. I mean, I watched Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon like 10 times. I knew, didn't I?
Yeah, right.
I didn't. So she said, come learn. And I joined her dojo and trained for years. And it's just, it's an amazing experience. Extremely empowering. Most of the students were women. And there is something very empowering about having a deadly weapon in your hand. I know, more contrast. But to learn how to use it. And we were doing all the forms that the samurais would do before they went into battle. And it's, you're doing this ancient art, and you realize that you're making the same moves that these true warriors did like hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So it's a very rich experience, and it certainly improved my sword scenes in the books. But as far as peace, the entire experience, because you aren't actually killing anyone, you aren't actually, you can't spar, because these are swords. It's not like, you know, you put some chin pads on and stuff. Actually, I think in Aikido, they do put a bunch of armor on and hit each other with sticks. But this, with the sword, with the Aido, there's no sparring. It's all you, the sword, and the movements. And it's incredibly meditative. It's incredibly difficult at first. And when you actually make the sword sing and it's happening, it's just utterly empowering. So there is that moment. There is a peace in it, because you get into that, I have to say the word, Zen state with the experience. I don't think I would have that experience if I had to go out and defend the empire.
Yeah, exactly.
But my characters do. And it was interesting when my publisher first read the manuscript, she called me on the phone. She was super excited about it. And she said, the sword scenes are so authentic. Very rewarding. And it was awesome.
So moving into astrology now, what sort of approach do you take in your astrology?
Well, I do a thing that I call Astro LOA, which is a law of attraction based astrology, which sounds all new and rah-rah, but it isn't. It isn't new at all. It's old. When my very first formal teacher, when I was 17, first thing she said to me is when she was talking about the planets, because of course you got the signs and planets and houses, and you're just learning the language and getting a handle on all the components of this symbol system. And she said, Mercury is everything. Mercury represents communication and the mind and thoughts. And she said, everything you think, everything that Mercury in your chart is generating, that's your reality. She was saying thoughts become things long before it became popularized, which, and of course, this tradition goes back thousands of years. And so the approach, I call it a law of attraction approach. And my idea is to educate people, because obviously astrology has gotten into hands of so many different hands, and hands that are not necessarily, some of the interpretations just make me cringe at what's, textbooks, you know, you got whole textbooks written on, it's just not where it's at. So the approach is that the chart is a map, and it's the big thing about the map is it's describing the territory. It's describing your natural, authentic vibration in various areas of life. So just like you would consult the map if you wanted to go on a holiday, like, oh, do I want to go to the mountains? Do I need a coat? Or am I going to the ocean and I'm going to bring my togs? You're looking to understand yourself. You're looking to understand your territory. What is it like there? What is it like when I relate? What is it like for me when I seek a career and want to create or start a family, or all those things are in there because it's a map. But you don't ask the map what you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
you don't
I
say
see
to
what
the,
you mean.
You don't say, the map is, hello, map, how's this going to go for me? It's going to talk about the terrain. So my purpose, so that must be true. My purpose is to get out there and re-educate the entire planet on this incredible tool that they have for self-understanding. Know thyself. This is the gift. And to when you know yourself, you get in alignment with what you really want. And this is meditation. This is your higher self. This is your purpose in life. And life changes. Everything around you changes. And I mean changes for the better.
Yeah. So by understanding our chart, basically, you're saying that we can really understand our life path, maybe? The north and the south nodes, are they really telling us the score?
It's okay, as the map tells you the score, yes. That map is telling you that, you know, the mountains are over here and they're this tall, and in the winter, that's the temperature. Yes, it's that literal. It's going to tell you the score of what your energy is and what happens when you go to those certain parts of yourself. And I think one of the greatest gifts of studying astrology or understanding what it's really about is non-judgment. First thing you do is you learn all 12 signs and you realize that we all have all 12 signs in our charts, and each sign, it has its own orientation, its own way of looking at things. And you start to open up and realize that, oh, there's not just one way. I'm not just all fire sign and all, you know, rah, charge forward. It's got to be this way. Oh, no, there's this earthy component. Oh, I understand that now. And, oh, there's this airy intellectual component. I understand that now. There's this watery, feeling, mute component. Now I understand that. We start to understand ourselves and accept and get in touch with, and we start to understand each other and appreciate the qualities in each other. It changes everything.
Right.
It changes everything.
Are there any important astrological events that we should be aware of right now or later into this year? Trends?
Yeah, there's there's exciting things always happening up there. And of course, every time there's like some big thing, everybody thinks, oh, this is the big thing. But there's big things happening all the time. There's always very, very cool things happening in this symbol system. But in particular tonight, or this is today, where are you in time-wise? You must be in...
We're Western Europe time.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, just a few hours ago, Saturn has just gone direct. And this is exciting because that retrograde period that we've experienced since February-ish has probably, for a lot of people, coincided with feeling like, oh, things are not moving forward, especially ideas that we had in November 2011. Feels like a lot of people are saying, oh, it's stuck, or that fell apart, or relationships, oh, you know, there's been this feeling of things not moving forward. Mainly that's because when Saturn went retrograde, the message is basically, you want to reflect on this. You want to dial it back, slow down. Don't push forward so far. Go back. There's something to look, reflect on. And most of the time we don't do that. We have our idea and we want to create it, and let's do everything we can to push it forward as fast as we can. And that's why it feels like there's been resistance. But now, hopefully we've all done reflecting. Maybe we've been forced to reflect. And it feels like we're being forced. And can very much feel like that. And now there is a feeling of moving forward, and especially projects that we had in mind in November are going to start to, we're going to see some results more at the pace that we generally feel comfortable with. So that's exciting.
Yeah,
and
that's
also
great news.
Yes, that's, and Venus in a couple days is going to go forward again. So there's been a months-long transit in the sign of Gemini, which is very rare, and there's a once-in-a-lifetime experience of Venus occulting or transiting the sun, which just happened a few weeks ago. And those, of course, we don't know a lot about what that actually means for individuals, because astrologers have only been aware of it, Western astrologers have only been aware of it for a short period of time. And so we don't know quite how to nail this, but with Venus turning direct on the 28th, again, a feeling of things, especially in terms of creativity, money, relationship, we get a feeling that we've readjusted, we've seen the light a bit in some ways, and now we move forward with a lot clearer intention, and we're more in touch with what we really want, not what we thought we wanted, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course it does. So how influenced are we really by these transits? Do we have a choice or not? You know, even if someone didn't believe in some of these influences?
Absolutely, always have a choice. And it's, I don't even use the word influence. This is part of my, or I try not to, re-education, because what we're seeing is the as above, so below. Things are happening in consciousness here in me, in you. And it is reflected out there in the movement of the planets. And, okay, it seems like, okay, Saturn goes retrograde and we think, oh, crunch, everything's going to be hard to move forward. That is not the energy of Saturn. Saturn's not up there making a decision, oh, you've got this project and I think you need to think on it more. I'm going to make it really hard for you to move forward. That's not what's happening. What's happening is a higher intention in consciousness to get something right. Saturn's big thing is authenticity, being authentic to ourselves. And often we get an idea and we push forward and it starts to happen, but the idea was something that maybe we wanted years ago and it's not authentic anymore. Or maybe it's something our partner or our parents wanted us to do and we're not consciously aware that it's not really our authentic goal. So what happens is the higher consciousness is wanting us to be in alignment with our authenticity and our truth. And we have a coinciding of Saturn retrograde with a time where we can get in touch with what we really want. And so that's not something happening to us because of that planet, and certainly not something negative happening. It's just consciousness evolving, basically, and the planet's movements out there reflecting it. But to answer your question about do we have a choice? Awareness gives us choice. I think the less you know about it, the more you are at the mercy of it. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds great, but I think the more aware you are, the more you can choose how you're going to respond to the energy. It's just energy. And if you resist it, it's going to hurt. It's going to crunch in some way in your life, and you're going to get pinched off, and you're not going to feel connected to your source, and it's not going to feel good. If you put awareness on it and just appreciate it as energy, you're open. Now it's flowing. You're going to experience it in a different way. So I can look at a person's chart, and if they are, let's say, not interested in astrology, not really interested in metaphysics or philosophy or opening their mind, they just want this career and that relationship, and let's just say they're focused on very practical things, and I can get extremely predictive with their chart. It's very easy for me to interpret how they're going to experience the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Because they're not asking questions. They're not at that point. They're not putting awareness on it. Therefore, they don't even know they have choices. They're just in reaction. So the person, the more aware a person is, the more the interpretation or the dialogue about what's happening astrologically becomes, it becomes more interesting, obviously. But there's just the choice, and there's always choice. And the choice is how you want to experience the energy. Do you want to judge it and see it as negative and, of course, experience it that way? Or are you going to just let go and go with the flow?
You did a draconic chart reading for me, and it was really accurate, by the way. Thanks for that.
Oh, thank you. I remember that, and I get very excited when I get asked to do the draconic readings, because not everybody's, you know, that's not their first go-to thing.
Why not? Why is the draconic chart not so popular?
Well, a lot of people don't know what it is. Very few astrologers use them. I don't even know anybody who uses it, but I'm sure they're out there. I think there's some books on them out there, so they definitely some astrologers using them. But when you look at the draconic, you're really looking in. You're saying, who am I? Who am I? And what is authentic to me on a really deep level? There's no, you know, pretending that there's a mundane question there, really. It's you're asking to go in. So that's very exciting kind of reading to do, because right away the person you're reading for is open. And so things just, yeah, tend to flow. And so it's popular, but to a smaller portion of the reading public.
Well, it was funny because you even mentioned, you know, with some communication stuff in there and radio, and that was right about the time when we were launching this little program. So even that was accurate.
Yeah, that's so exciting. And then you came back and said something about, or told me about your radio and would I be interested? I was like, oh, wow. Oh, gosh, that was fast. She got that together fast.
Funny.
Yeah, that was very cool. It's always super cool for me as an astrologer to get feedback like that, because you never, when you're reading, you're in your just kind of your little world, and it's you and the chart, and you're just connecting to it. But then when you get the you know, how the person is actually using that energy, that's exciting. To hear.
Well, as we begin to wind down, I just wanted to have you talk a bit about your new series that you're working on.
Okay. Oh, thank you for asking about that, because, just very briefly before we jump to the new series, there is a final book, it's a novella in the Earth and Gala series that's coming out soon. I don't have an exact date, but I just saw the book trailer my sister did for it, which will also be public soon. And it's just awesome.
And your son does the artwork, right? He does a great job.
Yeah. He did the artwork for the second series. And he's brilliant. They're both brilliant. They're brilliant. So it's wonderful to have that support. But this new, the new series is really exciting. It's very different from what I've been writing for the last decade. So it's based on, there are two huge prompts for it. And one is a John Waterhouse painting. I don't know if you know John Waterhouse.
Yes, I do.
Okay. And anyone interested, Google John Waterhouse, because he was, just beautiful,
yeah,
beautiful.
Definitely painting. Beautiful work.
Yeah. And this one's called The Siren. And I was just enchanted by this image, just enchanted, this beautiful siren with her music, and she's leaning over the rock, and this probably sailor that she's about to drown. I don't know. It's gorgeous young man looking
lure
up at
him
her.
And kill him, right?
No, I'm not sure. She looks very lovely. but this dynamic of the sea was just so powerful, and the idea of the sentient creatures of the sea and how alluring they are, and the idea of how we connect in the sea, being of course the unconscious. And I was fascinated. I have a print of that painting in my bedroom. And yeah, so that was part of what drew me to this new creation. And the other part was I was on YouTube. As you are.
Everyone goes on there.
And this is amazing. They have, you know how we were all, the continents were all one.
Right.
And slowly they separated out, and you can kind of watch that process. Well, you can keep watching and it keeps going. And in 250 million years from now, it's all back to one. And it's called Amasya. And that's the name of the series. And the idea is it's not futuristic in that sense, because 250 million years from now, and there's not even a lot of technology, but human genome has split, and there is a population that lives in the sea, under the water, in a kind of, they're called the Mar. And then there's a population that lives in the lands, which are this one beautiful continent and surrounded by the single sea. Stuff happens. It's very interesting.
Are you familiar with the expanding or growing Earth theory that said, you know, once all the continents were joined, but because Earth is growing, that's why all the continents started splitting and separating?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's not too popular, but it's out there.
Oh, I will look that up. I didn't know about that. That's very, interesting about the growth. Well, it's certainly alive. And things alive do tend to grow. So, interesting.
You also mentioned, I was reading an article, someone else interviewed you, that you were going to get into some DNA altering in your new book. Is that true?
That's interesting. Well, I'm not sure what I said, but there's a lot of DNA altering in the other books.
Okay, then maybe that's what it was. So that's my bad then.
Yeah. In the new series, things have changed. Definitely, the whole DNA has split and gone down two different tracks, and it's very obviously very far. We're looking extremely far in the future, and but in the, I suppose I just haven't left the whole DNA thing alone, have I? Because in the previous, I didn't realize that in the previous series, in the Earth and Gala series, there has been some very interesting changes done to the DNA. And when I wrote this, I put nanotechnology in the DNA in the series. I had my techno witches who were very sophisticated scientists do this. And while I was researching how this could possibly at the extreme stretch of the imagination be true, I found out that they had a model for it, that they, meaning us, our scientists, were already talking about doing it. So that was very cool and interesting. Their idea was to create nanotechnologies. We're talking about something very, very small. Nano quantum computers inserted into the DNA to monitor health and whatnot. I know. Well, they're probably pretty far away. I mean, it's not happening tomorrow, and maybe it's not happening at all, but people were thinking about it. But I thought, this is amazing. This is what I had my crew doing on their futuristic Earth, and then I found out that that happened with a few instances. But in Amasya, there is not we're jumping to that place, and we're not looking at what got them there, except the series of extinctions, because we have cycles of extinctions that we're not super aware of, because we don't last that long.
Yeah.
Humans, we're only on the planet for a short period of time.
And I think we're almost due for one, right?
not yet, but, well, not yet in the terms of anything that we would consider very close. But the cycles run about, well, there's major ones that run every 25,000 years. So what happens? And so a lot of the story is based on those cycles of extinction and how species survive, and how our human species has survived. So in that sense, there's been some major changes in our DNA.
I am definitely going to have to read this book series and get some of your other ones. So please tell us about your websites, where we can get your books and how people can get a reading.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I have, everyone's welcome to come and chat with me at my blog, which is called The 11th House. In astrology, you've got 12 houses, and the 11th house is the house of community and connection, like-minded others, and so forth. So it's called The 11th House, and it's kimfalconer.wordpress.com, and that's my blog, and it's just informal, but if you're interested in all the various happenings of law of attraction and for emerging writers and astrology and all that rah-rah is there in a current way. And if you want my basic site for my books, that's kimfalconer.com. And it's that site was designed by my son, and it's very cool in the sense I did all the HTML and CSS, so I made it circular. It's a portal, and you'll see when you go there. And there were no models for it. And it took me months to work out how to use it. But anyway, you have to be a little creative. You got to hover your mouse over the various glyphs and symbols to navigate around. So it's a participation experience there. But you can find out about my books and where to get them. You can get them anywhere in the world from fishpond.com, who ships for free. So I love fishpond.com. Oh,
nice.
Because they'll get my books anywhere. And plus, those who love their Kindles or Kobo and other devices can get them electronically through Kindle and their various outlets. Also, my astrology site, I've got this huge web presence. It's built up since, like, the internet started. So it's big. FalconAstrology.com is my main astrology site where you'll see there's about, I don't know, 100 or more articles on astrology and so forth, and a lot of links to current things that I've got going on. And then I'm on Facebook and Twitter, so I'm pretty accessible if anyone wants to connect.
That's right. Okay, well, thanks a ton for coming on and speaking with me. I knew you were going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And this has just been a wonderful delight.
And thank all of you across the planet for listening. No matter what it may appear to be, we can and do possess the power to manifest our own reality. Until we meet again, have a pleasant morning, afternoon, or night.